And that's the kicky music that means it's time once again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And as you're listening to this, I'm not in the country. I'm in London.
But she's actually been detained.
But for the moment, I am around the table with the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. Glenn Weldon, what do you do for NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Trey Graham, what do you do for NPR?
I'm the movies editor at NPR.org, and I'm the guy who got Linda Holmes detained because I gave her bad advice about tickling the beefeaters.
Tickling the beefeaters.
Oh, my favorite euphemism.
Goodness. And Stephen Thompson, what do you do for NPR?
I am a writer and editor at NPR.org, and as Linda Holmes' best pal, I may be expected to post bail.
42 quid! A tuppence!
God. You don't know how much British money.
Actually, I have no idea. I'm hoping that's so. That's all I have.
I think they still use guineas. Use guineas.
Crowns.
Yeah, well, you know, somebody asked me over the weekend, they still use the pound, right? They didn't go to euros.
They
still use the pound. And I said, yes, that's correct. But I only know that because I've been reading books. And then my sister had to lend me the little thing to make the plug into the other kind of plug.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
It's just the whole thing is just a lot of freaking chaos. I'm
Got
just
yourself
saying.
Some hay pennies so you can buy a fat goose.
All right. We did 20 minutes on this last week. Let's move along, shall we?
Just be sure to mind the queue for the loo.
For God's sake.
So anyway, hopefully, as you hear this, everything is perfectly fine, and I am in London, crushed by a large crowd covering the royal wedding. But that's in the future. Right now, we're in the present. Our first topic for today, we're going to talk a little bit about adaptations. And what got us on this topic is that some of you, as well as much of the rest of the world, have been chit-chatting about the HBO adaptation of Game of Thrones, which we have mentioned here once or twice.
Just in passing.
I tuned it out, though, because I had not seen or read it. But now that I've seen it, I'm raring to go.
That's awesome, because I have, unfortunately, I was in the middle of shopping for an umbrella.
A bumbershoot.
Don't you mean a brawly?
I was just going to say, I think it's a brawly.
And I have not seen it, so I will have to turn it over to all of you. But I do have it. I will see it eventually.
Well, Stephen Thompson, how much of it have you seen?
I saw the entire first episode.
And you, Glenn Weldon, how much have you seen?
Zero. I don't have HBO, but I read the book.
All right, well, I win! I have seen 2.5 episodes. I am, for once, the most prepared person on the podcast.
Mike is clapping.
Well,
and I only paid close enough attention. I didn't only watch the parts where there were boobs.
So three quarters of it.
I hear that covers a lot of it.
Yeah.
So let's start with Steven, just because it seems most adventurous.
Because it seems least likely to be informative.
What did you think of it, Thompson?
You know, I'm still getting my feet wet in the universe. I mean, unlike our man Glenn Weldon, who knows things like who people are and what's going on, I was sort of expected to jump into this new world and you know, for example, in the opening scene, it's not really giving anything away. There's a band of royal hunters who find a dangerous place and I'm watching it and I'm like, that could be the hero. Right there, that could be the hero. Okay, that's not the hero.
Yes, it is true. The groundwork laying that goes on in the first hour is deliberately paced, is how I would put it.
I heard it picks up on the second episode, though.
It does. It picks up a bit. And, you know, there's more incest.
Well, there's incest in that.
Yeah.
But there's also, obviously, having just seen the first episode, you sort of get a sense of, like, well, as the queen's royal blah, 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 there's a lot of that natural exposition-y stuff that you only really get in first episodes of these things. But I found it engaging. It's certainly, very, very, very slickly made. I mean, it could have just as easily been a cinematic enterprise. As far as the effects and the grimness and the score and the pomp,
it's quite Lord of the Ringsy.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn was saying that the characters are better imagined in terms of motivation in the books than Lord of the Rings, right? And wasn't that one of your observations?
It's more about intrigue and backstabbing and psychology, and not about this guy is good and this guy is swarthy and therefore evil.
It will not come as a surprise because you get most of this early on in the first episode, but the nasty people are all pale and blonde and pretty.
Mm-hmm. That's true. The blondness seems to be a sign of villainy.
Yes, it is an indicator. But
so it's kind of the opposite of Disney.
Mm-hmm. That's also true on The Real Housewives. I just want to pitch in something that I have
Spoiler.
Seen. So I just,
Spoiler.
So.
I have to say, as a fan of things like Titus Andronicus, this series is deliciously interested in gore.
Yeah, there's a lot of... spluttering wounds.
Well, and, you know, entrails and maggots and all kinds
loppings
of all kinds of deliciousness. Yes,
maggots.
Close up.
So I don't really remember anything that happened in the books because I just don't retain much from books.
No, not at all.
So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing this adaptation because what I remember from the books, what I remember from all books I read, is more the tone, the mood, a moment, a character. I remember Tyrion, the guy played by Peter Dinklage. Mm-hmm. I remember really liking that character. And
oh, he is having a grand old time in this thing.
He's acting the hell out of
yes,
that
Yes, he
show.
Is.
Good.
And not in a big scenery chewing kind of way. No. I mean, he's got those scenes, but, you know, in the first couple of episodes, he's got several quiet moments where you begin to see why he drinks so much and wenches so much.
Mm-hmm. Why'd you read so much?
Look at me and tell me what you see.
Is this a trick?
What you see is a dwarf. If I had been born a peasant, they might have left me out in the woods to die. Alas, I was born a Lannister of Casterly Rock. Things are expected of me. I must do my part for the honor of my house, wouldn't you agree? But how? Well, my brother has his sword, and I have my mind, and a mind needs books like a sword needs a whetstone. That's why I read so much, Jon Snow.
Swiving. He's swiving. I'm looking forward to seeing this because, again, I don't remember stuff that happens. I don't remember plot, but I remember little moments. So that's why there are certain things I want to see adaptations of and certain things I never want to see adaptations
of.
Right.
I was thinking about this today. What I want to see an adaptation of desperately is something like a big hunkin' Russian novel that I'm never going to read.
Oh, yeah.
Because to me, reading a book that's been translated into English is kind of like, feels to me like reading Braille through mittens. You know, it feels like I'm not really getting the book itself. I'm getting somebody's interpretation of it. And the reason I feel that is that I've read Madame Bovary a couple times, and it felt like reading two different books. Because, again, what do I retain? Mm-hmm. Not plot, but the feeling of it. Mm-hmm. So if I ever read Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, I'm going to forget it pretty much the next day, and I'm going to remember the feeling of it. And it depends on who translated it is kind of creating that feeling. So that's why I want to see an adaptation of something like Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, because I just want to know what happens.
For me, I want that adaptation to take place so I can ignore both.
I see.
Ignore the books, yes. Not to, you know, put it on the exactly the same par, but have you seen Dr. Zhivago?
Long time.
That is the kind of ago. That is the kind of adaptation, you know, gigantic, sweeping, epic adaptation that doesn't often get made anymore, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's also the kind of gigantic, sweeping adaptation that tends to come in for a lot of criticism in the sense that you always lose a lot. People always tell you that you lose a lot from the book because if the book is 1,000 pages long, you're
no
certainly
way
not going
to
fit everything into, I mean, you know, let's face it, if they got to break the last Harry Potter book into two movies.
Yeah.
Or the Twilight.
Or Twilight.
Or if they take Tom Bombadil out of the first Lord of the Rings movie, which was a scandal
to a
very small selection.
Travesty.
Was it really?
You know what I want? I never want to see an adaptation of is something like H.P. Lovecraft or Edgar Allan Poe, not because they're brilliant writers. I mean, I happen to enjoy them a hell of a lot, but because I'm reading it in English, therefore the dread and the gloom and everything you go to Poe and Lovecraft for is sort of hardwired into the language. I feel like if somebody just makes a movie of that, they're just going to tell me what happened, and I don't care what happened.
You know going in it's going to be gray.
Right. And it's going to be a horror. There'll be squishy monsters with tentacles, and I don't care about that. That's a horror thing. There is in the works, or at least there was up to about a month ago, a huge adaptation of a H.P. Lovecraft novel called At the Mountains of Madness, which is a very Lovecraftian kind of title. It had Guillermo del Toro. It had James Cameron. It had Tom Cruise involved. And I think as of last month, it just got sort of put on hold. It was supposed to be coming out in 2013. I am happy about that because I don't want to see tentacled creature movie. I want to feel that sort of ridiculous, word choicey, over-the-top gothic stuff that those guys are known for.
Yeah. Well, the other problem, too, with adaptations of stuff with big monsters is the whole thing that Stephen King has said about having his scary books adapted, which is, to me, the best example of this is It.
Yeah.
And
there
are parts of the TV miniseries of It that were actually very good. Mm-hmm. There are parts of it that are deeply creepy and quite effective. But ultimately, you're going to run into the big scary monster.
Right.
And when you do, when you read about it in the book, it is infinitely big.
Yeah.
When you read about it in the book, it can be, in your imagination, infinitely large and frightening. As soon as you have to shoot it, it's just a puppet.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's one of the reasons why a writer like Stephen King that has who has the ability to write story and not just horror. Mm-hmm. Many times it's the non-horror adaptations that have been more successful, I think, because you get all of the stuff about the creepiness and the character stuff that he does without having that problem of how do you shoot this thing that is so scary in the book so that it doesn't look ridiculous. Like, for example, I haven't seen the movie of The Mist, but the story, The Mist, have you read The Mist? Anybody
long time ago,
read
yeah.
The Mist? The Mist is about a mist and these people getting trapped in a grocery store as this terrifying mist rolls in. And then there are monsters mm-hmm. who sort of emerge from it. And the story is really, really freaky scary. I didn't go see the movie because I feel like making it that literal is just asking for trouble. I feel like it's going to look silly. Whereas those horror stories have the same character stuff that he does in stories like Stand By Me and Shawshank and stuff like that. But those stories don't have that challenge of how do you present this sort of paranormal thing so that it doesn't seem ridiculous.
Yeah.
He just wrote this story, Under the Dome, which I liked parts of and didn't like parts of. It's another one of his big, gigantic brick novels. Mm-hmm. But when I thought about it, it's like if you tried to make that into a movie, trying to portray the idea of an invisible dome under which everyone is trapped really...
It's a lot of mime.
It's a lot of mime.
It's like Wonder Woman and the invisible plane.
It's a lot of... So that's one of my struggles with adaptations is once you translate them into something literal, they become smaller.
Yeah.
And less effective.
Well, a lot of stuff of his stuff has been done on the cheap as television miniseries. You had the problem, you're exactly right, with It, when it was Tim Curry as Scary Clown. Clowns
Creepy.
Are scary. Terrifying. When it was Giant Spider, you know, you felt like he wanted to step on it.
Right.
It was a big spider.
And like I said, spider puppet. Big
exactly.
spider puppet,
exactly.
And that's all you're going to see.
And on the Langoliers, you know, there was this thing with these just horrible CGI little chumpy things, little Pac-Men kind of eating things. It's like, it's hard to be.
Whereas in the story of the Langoliers, it's still weird. I mean, it's still kind of a goofy idea, but mm-hmm. somehow the way you describe it, like you say with tone, you can describe it in such a way that it's still scary, mm-hmm. even so that they don't just look like, what are they called, koosh balls?
Yes.
Like menacing koosh balls.
Glenn mentioned Lovecraft, and I think another issue you're dealing with, and sort of part of what you're saying, Linda, is Lovecraft even had, how do you pronounce it? Help me out here.
Cthulhu.
I believe it's pronounced Cthulhu. Mm-hmm. Isn't part of the idea of that is that it is sort of this unspeakable...
Yes, that's what's so great about it. That's what I love about it. It's like, I cannot, it's a nameless inchoate. Mm-hmm. The elder gods who cannot be named, much less envisioned, for to envision them is to be driven mad. I love all that. So that's exactly what you're dealing
with. Once you suddenly have like a guy in a
squishing along
Cthulhu mask, it's not scary.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's not scary.
All right. So that's what shouldn't be adapted. Yeah. But Game of Thrones, you're happy about?
Sure. Because again, I don't really remember anything about the book except the feeling that everybody hated everybody else, and there was a lot of history that I wasn't getting. So great.
You know, not every edit is a bad edit,
mm-hmm.
And you make a decision about every story to have it be of a particular length with a particular amount of stuff in it, but that doesn't necessarily mean always that if you pare it down and make it shorter and cut some stuff out, that you will necessarily come up with a vastly inferior product. You're going to have a different product, but it just, you know, it kind of depends on what's in it.
That actually is connected to my idea about a thing that I would like to see adapted for the movies particularly, and that is the Franz Wedekind plays that center on Lulu.
Uh-huh.
The Lulu plays... they involve a girl who marries often, who has a little more fun than was considered entirely proper at the time. She murders a husband or two. I believe she has a lesbian affair. She eventually runs herself down and ends up working as a prostitute in London in Whitechapel. And anybody else remember who else was hanging out in Whitechapel in the late
1880s? Yes, we do, Professor Graham.
Jack the Ripper.
So does this have to do with Linda covering the royal wedding?
Yes. The story does not end well for Lulu, poor Lulu. And what I'm thinking for a movie is not like a straight-up reinterpretation of the plays, because there's a lot of play. There are two plays that tell her story. And even the streamlined English language adaptation of the Lulu story that I have seen is a little overlong and crammed with incident. There's an opera by Alban Berg that is much cleaner and kind of successful as an opera, but it's very, very heavy going, so you wouldn't want to see a film of that. That would be kind of a non-starter. But what I would kind of like is, you mentioned Guillermo del Toro earlier. I would like to see him or Baz Luhrmann or somebody with a really vivid visual sense tell this story musically with either songs from the catalog as Luhrmann did in Moulin Rouge or maybe some new songs by, I don't know, somebody like get Amy Winehouse to write a new song or two because,
nice. You
know, she lives in London and she's a little bit of a train wreck.
This is very imaginative.
So I would kind of, this is the property that I would like to see reimagined for the screen with music.
Yeah, you're talking about interpretation as opposed to simple adaptation.
Yeah.
And that's what makes, I'm going to go back to this again, the BBC series Sherlock so good because
yes,
it took the stories and it interpreted them, did more than just put them in a modern setting, but really thought about the characters and really thought about their relationship in a way.
My idea for something I wanted to see adapted is actually... They're not gonna do it because they've done it once.
Is it Gymkhana?
No, they've done it once, and I was dissatisfied. And I'm gonna explain why I'm dissatisfied. I was dissatisfied with the 1993 adaptation of The Firm, and I will tell you why. First of all, it is a terrific book. I don't care what anybody says. That is a terrific pop novel. If you think about the number of times that Grisham has essentially written the same book over and over and get people to buy it, it's because he writes that book very well. This particular book I read, you know, at the same time everyone else in the entire universe was reading it. And then they did the movie with Tom Cruise, which was an okay idea because, you know, he makes a pretty decent slickster Grisham hero. Not as good as Matthew McConaughey, I would say, in A Time to Kill, but... you know, a perfectly good hero. But assuming that I can spoil the book and the movie, given that it, you know, the movie came out in 1993, the big difference between the book and the movie is that in the book, it is sort of this Grisham-y ending where you never get everything at the end. You always have to make some kind of sacrifice to do the right thing. That's kind of what he sets up always in these books. What winds up happening in the book is that the lawyer who has discovered essentially that his giant firm is in league with the mob, in the book, he sort of manages to kind of screw the firm and screw the mob and steal a bunch of money and disappear. And he has to sort of disappear into the Caribbean on a boat because he's going to be on the run probably for the foreseeable future. You know, in a sense, it's not that much of a sacrifice because he runs away with $10 million and winds up on a boat in the Caribbean. But he does have to give up his entire life because there's no neat way to do what he needs to do. So he does it the non-neat way. In the movie, it all turns into a big scandal about overbilling. And then and he manages to kind of turn everybody in without really doing anything bad. And he brings down the mob and he brings down the firm. Then they just move to a different city. And that's it. What he always does at the end of the good books is you always lose part of your life when you get ripped out of it into some crazy situation that you have to crusade against some power bigger than yourself.
Right, yeah.
You never have the ability to just bring everybody down and then just go back to what you were doing.
Right. I mean, the price you have to pay reinforces the bravery of the choice.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so even though it is a pop novel, which I try not to take too terribly seriously, and there have been good Grisham adaptations. I actually think The Pelican Brief is a good movie and A Time to Kill is a good movie. That's the movie that made everybody think Matthew McConaughey was going to be, you know, a gigantic and serious movie star.
It's getting a stage adaptation, you know.
Oh, is it?
Coming in May to Arena Stage before it goes to Broadway.
I did not know.
Will it be as sweaty and as shirtless as that movie?
It is very sweaty.
Let us hope.
The biggest problem with that movie is that it is comically sweaty.
Hand Luke Esquire.
There are some comically sweaty parts. But anyway, so what I would like to see is a better representation of the ambiguities, a darker, slightly less slick adaptation of that.
I like that your choice is essentially, I wish somebody would adapt a John Grisham book.
I'm not. Oh, what's your choice? Smartsy McReadalong.
Well, you know, I figured I'd take the latest book I've read. It's a little tome called Lily's Big Day. A young mouse.
Oh boy!
With dreams of okay,
she has dreams of being a flower girl.
I'm going to base this on the last thing I read. I'm talking about a movie called Cheerios: The Box.
I have a dream project that I've actually thought about for a long time that I've plotted out that works, but will never happen. It's the Muppets. You know how the Muppets do adaptations of every book in the world.
Sure.
They address the works of Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, the title Jesus Christ Superfrog. I have worked this out.
Yes.
You can line up every single Muppet with their corresponding cast member. It just would be so awesome.
Please tell me more.
Well, I don't have it's of course, you know, you have Ralph as Herod.
Sure.
It's Gonzo as Pilate. No. We have to get some of the Sesame Street people in here, so it's the Count as Pilate.
Oh, yes. Have to do that. Yes.
One, two, That's... But it's...
Oh, no.
I'll try to post it on the Facebook site. I have it all worked out.
Are we assuming that Piggy is Mary Magdalene?
Of course. Yeah. Bert and Ernie is Caiaphas and the other guy.
You know? I don't know how to... I know!
What then to do about Jesus of Nazareth? Like that. Perfect. It all lines up. And you got to imagine Kermit last scene.
You have murdered me.
So good. It works, I tell you.
And thus concludes another episode.
I will try to find it.
I really want to get them to get to Starlight Express so they can all be on the roller skates. All the Muppets on skates. The big, you know how they used on the Muppet Show to do the big giant Muppets?
Yes.
And they could be on the roller skates.
Sweetums, yes.
Playing the train. Sweetums as the train in Starlight Express. Mm-hmm. I like it already. Mm-hmm. I like it already. And I'm thinking Janice as Evita.
Although you can't snub Piggy for Evita. My God, she would kill you.
That's true. She would kill me.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway. It's like that idea is so genius, Glenn, that I'm just sitting here
in
shock.
You would be surprised. Now, I have to use a lot of Sesame Street characters, so it really would never, ever work. I mean, I actually had delusions.
It was a great idea.
I actually wrote a letter to Jim Henson. When I was in college, I came up with this. Jim Henson was still around. And I was like, look, I get it. This is a tough sell. But hear me out. Maybe it was Fozzie as Herod. Fozzie as Herod makes more sense.
Does it?
Yes. No, it seriously does.
Whew. Well, I didn't know where that was going, but yeah. I'm always happy with where you take us, Glenn, even though I don't always know where we're going. Mm. All right. So you should feel free, all of you out there, to come to the Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH or come find us on the blog at Monkey C and tell us about your adaptations and, I think, help us cast Jesus Christ Superfrog, because I think that's what we're going to be doing all week. I think we're going to be working on this for a while. So the next thing we were going to talk about today, slightly inspired by my pilgrimage to London, we were going to talk a little bit about pop culture, travel, stories. Mm. And I'm going to kick this one off by starting with Trey Graham, who explained to us that he had a pop culture travel tale to tell. And we were going to see how much he wanted to tell us, how much we could figure out and intuit. Yep. Why don't you tell us some of your story?
What I said to the team when we were discussing topics for this week is that if we were going to talk about pop culture travel, I wanted to pose a question and see what their answer might be. If I told you that I had traveled to an awesome place, and while standing in line to see an awesome thing, I had remembered that one of my favorite Broadway shows is about that place, what might your first guess be about the place and the show?
Old Faithful. No.
You were to Brigadoon?
Let's see. Favorite Broadway shows is about that place. Rydell High? Did you go to Rydell High?
Did you go to Kansas City and find that everything was up to date?
All right, fine.
Wait, did you go to Thailand, which used to be Siam?
Maybe.
You guys are so much quicker on the uptake than I am. I'm just sitting here trying.
The South Pacific might be a good idea because I am as corny as Kansas in August.
It's true. Mm. Did you go to, let's see, favorite Broadway shows? What does Trey
like? Ragtime?
Like?
You said Ragtime yesterday.
He does like Ragtime.
I do like Ragtime.
Mm-hmm. All right, I need another hint.
All right, On the Town would be a good guess, right?
Oh, I see.
New York, New York.
Right.
That's
like
that not
one.
It. Not it.
Okay.
It would also be reasonable to speculate that I might have gone to a baseball game. For instance, the organized night out at Nationals Park with the Sporty Gays here in Washington.
Sort
of organized Sporty Gays.
And you were overwhelmed by your memories of your good man, Charlie Brown.
I might have sung Whatever Lola Wants.
From Damn Yankees.
That's right. Which, for Thompson's benefit, is a musical about a baseball game.
I've seen the movie. Okay.
But the fact is that also is not the answer. The answer is something else entirely. Mike Katziff, music cue number one.
It's the land of naked marble balls.
go to Oz?
The clue is right there in the lyrics. She says these are very popular in Italy.
Light in the Piazza?
Very good.
Hey,
Glenn Weldon.
There's Piazza in there. These are,
these are very popular in Italy. It's the land of naked marble boys. She's looking at the David. The music is by Adam Gettle. The story is based on a novella from the 1950s by a woman named Elizabeth Spencer. And it is not available on Netflix streaming, so that is what is not making me happy this week, aww, I have to say. But I was in Florence. I was waiting in line to get into the Uffizi. And Keith and I, my other half, sort of decided that we would listen to this on the shared headphone jack of the iPod as, aww, kind of a little joke, right? Because it's a musical about tourists going to Italy. And then I found myself kind of really being swept away by the music, which ranges from that jaunty, youthful sound in the clip I just played for you to some pretty big and lush melodies. And I wanted to ask Mike to play you one of those, too.
On a central square, in a city made of statues and stories, go on and tell me what they mean. It ignited them like a beacon coming out of the dark.
That lyric about a central square, that's the Piazza della Signoria in the middle of Florence with the tower standing over it. And it's just up against the promenade where the entrance to the Uffizi is. And it's not like I hadn't thought about what Florence means and what its connection is to so much of what we think is beautiful and important about civilization. But it was strangely enough the romance of this musical, which is written by an American with songs told from the perspective of a visitor who was thrilled to be there, that brought it emotionally home in that moment. So that is my pop culture travel story, and you can call me sappy if you like, but I defy you to stand in the shadow of Michelangelo's David, watching one of the most spectacular sunsets in the world and drinking Tuscan red wine that you have smuggled up the steps to the top of the hill and not get a little weepy.
You said it was going to be a mortifying story. There's nothing mortifying about
that. It's mildly mortifying. I listen
story
to the light in the piazza while I'm standing in the piazza. It's a little darky.
No, it's awesome. It's a lovely story. Glenn Weldon, travel story?
There's certain movies and films that you kind of use as a travel book.
Sure.
And that's what I did when I was a younger man, a college student. I fell in love with a 1987 film called Wings of Desire.
Uh-huh.
If you're not familiar with this film, this is the uber-pretentious film of uber-pretentious films. It's shot in black and white. It's called in German, Der Himmel über Berlin, because it's about these angels who hang around the city of Berlin and sort of watch humans and listen to our thoughts and record our thoughts and our behaviors, and they're invisible to us. One of these angels falls in love with a trapeze artist, as you do, and decides that he's going to become human. They go together to see Nick Cave. And end of movie. It is just fantastic. I was listening to a lot of Crime in the City Solution then, as the characters in this movie do. And I took a train from Vienna, the midnight train from Vienna to Berlin. I got into Berlin before dawn, and I decided I would make this film my pop culture pilgrimage. And I just took off from the train station and thinking, well, Berlin's a walkable city. Berlin is not a walkable city. But I did find this giant victory column near the Brandenburg Gate, which is where the angels hang out on at the beginning of the film. I did go to the Berlin Wall and chip off a couple pieces of the Berlin Wall and smuggle them back home because it's a large, many of the scenes are set in that sort of plaza. I did find the Staatsbibliothek, which is this library and this really fascinating scene in the movie where all the angels sort of hang out and listen. And remember, at this time I was sleep deprived and I was also starving, so I was hallucinating angels everywhere. there is a circus in this movie, and one of the reasons I love this film is because at one point the trapeze artist gets down off her trapeze, walks through her shabby, about-to-close circus into her trailer to stare into her makeup mirror, and the camera is in her makeup mirror, and she just stares at us for what seems like 45 minutes, but actually it's about 30 seconds, silent, and she just says, Delire, and the subtitle comes up, Emptiness. And I was like, yes, I love this movie. I eat this movie up with a spoon. And so I turned a corner, and there was a poster for a circus in town that day. So I went to the circus, and I saw, you know, it wasn't as cinematically shabby as the the one there. But then as I was going back to the train, I saw another poster for Nick Cave.
Oh,
he was doing a reading, not he wasn't playing, but it was for Nick Cave, who was all over the soundtrack of this film, and so I went to see him read a terrible book that he had written, and I fell asleep like six times because it was like it seemed like the reading was at midnight. That's what I remember. But it was so fantastic. It was a perfect pop culture travelogue kind of day.
Oh my God, my story is so bad compared to
I was going to say, and next.
I'm going to let you tell yours next, Thompson, and hope that mine will look better after you.
Well, as you know, I'm a globe-trotting man about town.
Yes.
Gadabout, who's
traveled the world on a prayer. So the story that popped into my head was when I was seven, my family took a train somewhat across the country from the Cleveland area, where I lived until I was 10, to the World Science Fiction Convention, which in 1979, I want to say, was in Denver, Colorado. And when we got to the Denver area, my parents took a little detour as a surprise. We got to see the front of Mork and Mindy's house.
Oh, that's so awesome.
I think that holds up.
No, this isn't going to make my story any better.
And I remember just being absolutely, utterly awed. Like, that's it. It wasn't like the set of Mork and Mindy.
It's just the front of the house.
Mork and Mindy were supposed to live in the mountains, and so they had, sort of the way I'm sure on Newhart, they had a photo of an inn in New England. Mm-hmm. They had like a photo of a house in Boulder, Colorado. But seeing that house, man, it was like entertainment is not so far away. Right.
It's made from real things.
It's made from real things. It is not some fantastical otherworldly thing. And even little 7-year-old gigantic-headed Stephen Thompson could see Mork and Mindy's house. It was there. It was there to be touched. It was probably the pivotal moment of my entire life, and I just realized it just now.
Mm-hmm. That is awesome.
It's not a piazza, and it's not a Berlin, but it is Mork and Mindy's house.
Outstanding. Well, my story is terrible. Compared to all of these, I'm just going to tell you right now, my story is terrible, but it
was... Keep selling it, Holmesy.
For one thing, I was not a child. I was an adult. I was a childlike adult. Do any of you know what the Satellite of Love is?
Sure.
Okay. Mm. Satellite of Love is the home of the robots and Joel and or Mike on Mystery Science Theater 3000. The Satellite of Love existed at Best Brains, which is a studio outside Minneapolis. And when I was, it would have been 1992 or 3, when my family was first living in Minneapolis, in the Minneapolis area, I trundled myself out to Best Brains, and it turned out that they would just kind of show you around. Like, you know, it wasn't, the show was fairly culty still at that point. It was on Comedy Central by then. This was after it had moved from local television to Comedy Central. But, you know, I think when I went, they had a tour, and I think there were probably like five of us, and they took us around, and we saw like the little puppet area. We saw the foam globe that they rotate in the credits, which is about 2 feet across, and you could see like how they painted it and everything. And we saw the little cardboard cutout thing that they, or maybe plywood, that created the silhouette of seats across the front. And I stood on the bridge of the Satellite of Love.
Dude, and you downplayed that?
That's
awesome.
Not bad at all.
You see any of them? Any of them there?
No. No, the actual true full-use puppets were on tour somewhere at that time. They were out being shown somewhere, so we did not get to see them. But there were a bunch of like spare parts. Mm-hmm. Like you could see the little lacrosse mask.
Oh, yeah?
You could see little spare parts of them all over the place. But it was not a long pilgrimage. It was a short but critical visit to something that I thought was cool. And I just went out there and had them show me around.
Dude,
it was
that
really
so counts.
Nerdy.
It was really,
really
counts.
And I think one other point and one other thing to sort of ask the listeners at home to come up with is not only your own pop culture pilgrimages, mm-hmm. but your pop culture pilgrimage soundtracks. Mm-hmm. What do you mm-hmm. listen to, just as Trey and Keith were listening to whatever play that was? and you know, and Glenn had to Nick Cave.
You're a Philistine.
What, you know, piece of music do you associate with your pop culture pilgrimage? I think one thing that, you know, that I had thought about mentioning is every time I have to drive any amount of distance through the state of Illinois, you know, I like to listen to Sufjan Stevens' album Illinois, mm-hmm. in part because driving through Illinois is so awful. Mm-hmm. And even better, when you're driving through Indiana, I cannot drive through Indiana without listening to David Mead's album Indiana, which is just a treasure and makes driving through Indiana a million times better. And it's actually about driving through Indiana. So when you have a piece of music that is associated with your pop culture place, I think it's that much sweeter. And if you've got some at home, please recommend them on our Facebook page or on the blog.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. So as always, we are going to close out this week with a quick round of what's making you happy this week. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
This will be quick. Doctor Who is back. Mm. 6 episodes starting last week, and then they're going to take a break for the summer, and then they're going to come back. The 4th episode is going to be written by a guy named Neil Gaiman, who this is a sort of nerd confluence that has not happened heretofore. So the first episode that was on brings the Doctor and his companions to America, to actually 1969 Washington, D.C. That has everything you want. It's got big scary monsters. It's got cheesy special effects. And a long tradition with the show that superfans like me will appreciate: terrible American accents.
Nice.
Oh my God. These are good British actors, and they can't quite. Anyway, so not since Perpigillium Brown have we heard such a terrible American accent on the show, but it's great. It's welcome back.
Very good. Nice. Sounds excellent. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I did not have a whole lot that was making me happy this week. So, as you may have noticed, while you were telling your travel story, I was Googling for things that might conceivably have cropped up to make me happy.
Graham happiness.
Right,
exactly.
No.
And I did in fact
Facebook.
I did in fact find something. I found the news that Elton John has his child's breast milk shipped in via FedEx. And that is not necessarily what's making me happy, but the fact that we still have People magazine around to bring us these important bits of information, that's what's making me happy.
Well done.
Somewhere someone was on Deadline.
Yep.
I think Trey was on Deadline.
somebody had a column to fill.
Boy. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, speaking of filling unusual deadlines, there are strange days. And there are days when you are inadvertently called upon to broker a dispute between Lady Gaga's manager and Weird Al Yankovic. On Wednesday of last week, like many entertainment reporters on a slow news day, was called upon to research why Lady Gaga had rejected Weird Al Yankovic doing a parody of her song Born This Way. I had heard from Weird Al that she had turned him down, and I, like the intrepid reporter that I am, reached out to Camp Gaga to try to sort out, hey, you know, it is hard-hitting news, people. We don't just report one side of the news.
Worst summer camp ever.
It's a lot of egg lifting. And by the end of that day, I received a breathless phone call from the man himself, from Yankovic, not the manager, informing me.
I thought you meant Lady Gaga.
That Lady Gaga had and her people had reversed course.
Yes.
And Lady Gaga, who had actually never herself turned down Weird Al Yankovic to include a parody of her song Born This Way on his new album, Lady Gaga has in fact allowed Weird Al Yankovic, has freed Weird Al Yankovic from the shackles of her rejection.
And you helped.
And I was trying to report a story and was going back and forth between the two parties involved, and I like to think helped in some tiny way to make that, you know,
to,
I don't make
to
art
to clarify a misunderstanding.
You inadvertently created détente, or as he would call it, fondant.
This is the value of a free and independent media.
I like to think of myself as the Jimmy Carter to their Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin.
Yes, indeed. Good Lord.
Okay, so what is making me happy this week? On last week's episode of Community, Thursday night's episode of Community, there was a, they did a thing where it was sort of a takeoff of a clip show. And so it was like, there were like 70 scenes and it was phony flashbacks, some of which referred to real things that had happened on the show, but were extra scenes that you would have never seen.
Jeff and Britta are having secret sex. Exhibit A, the one thing I do remember from Halloween.
Hi.
Hi.
You need some help in there?
Yeah, well, I can't use my hands in this costume.
Exhibit B, something I overheard during Christmas.
What are you doing later? How about some holiday benefits?
Hey, ixnay in front of Unken Day.
Some of which were just bizarre and crazy.
And finally, Exhibit C, the curious circumstances following the exciting conclusion of our St. Patrick's Day adventure.
Oh!
Hobbit! A leprechaun took our clothes!
And you can never tell anyone, okay?
But one of the things that it included, as it must, as such things must, is a musical montage of moments to the song Gravity by Sarah Bareilles. And the joke of the montage was that it was meaningless moments cut together to music to look like a montage of a love story being created.
Oh, you compartmentalized, did you? Then what's been going on with us all year?
What are you talking about?
Talking about the Annie of it all. The long looks, the stolen glances, the general atmosphere of would they, might they?
Annie, I think you're reading into some things.
Oh, really?
Something always brings me back to you. It never takes too long. No matter what I say or do, I still feel you here till the moment I'm gone.
And after they did it with Jeff and Annie, they did it with Abed and Pierce, I think, and then somebody with the monkey. And so they kept going back and doing these montages with the same song. And the joke was, these are meaningless moments that have been cut together to look like a sweet montage. If you read carefully Dan Harmon's Twitter account, Dan Harmon is the creator and showrunner of Community, and you could see him going back and forth with a couple of fans. It turns out that there's a fan who had done a real Jeff and Annie fan video to that song.
Oh.
It's kind of a piece of fan art. Uh-huh. And she had done, you know, it's one of these YouTube fan videos. And it suffers from the same exact thing, which is it's a bunch of things that aren't anything cut together to look like it's people looking longingly at each other. And it could have come off like a nasty cut at your own fans, which is not a very nice thing to do. And there were people who interpreted it that way, people who knew that this video existed. But the woman who had done the video just thought it was the best thing that ever happened to her in her whole life and decided to take it as well-intentioned and good-humored. He told her he intended it as a love letter to the devoted, crazy fans. She took it that way. Everybody lived happily ever after. It was something where it could have turned out to be an ugly thing, and instead it turned out to be a very loving thing. And it's hard to find a way to do a shout-out to fans that feels appropriate and, you know, where you can kind of have a little bit of loving fun with your own, you know, nutty, and I say that, you know, affectionately, your own nutty fans. And I thought that was very awesome. And I should say, speaking of nutty fans,
yes,
that the other thing making me happy this week that I should mention, I have two things I want to mention quickly from our own fans who I would never call nutty.
Never.
The one is that two of our awesome super fans sent me a Kindle book to take with me on my trip to London.
Aww.
And I just want to thank them for that.
Lovely.
They know who they are. Really appreciate it. Lovely of you.
And nobody sent me
anything. And I also want to thank, I never know whether people want us to give out their full name, so I'll just say Scott, who has been sending us postcards.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
Scott has been sending us a series of postcards, and one of them came to the entire team, and then they have been arriving one at a time for everybody else. And they are really cute and really awesome. And maybe we will take a picture of some of the art from one of them and show you a little bit of what they look like. But they are original pieces of art sent to us as postcards.
Artist renderings of what he imagines we look like?
I think sort of. Yeah, based on what we've described ourselves to be like. And so it's great. And it was very sweet. And it's original art. And what's better than that? So I did want to just recognize quickly those two very nice things,
those
which also
lovely.
Are making me happy this week, in addition to the sender of candy who has been thanked online. Anyway, thank you for the candy and books and lovely things.
We are just the most pathetic grubbers.
Yeah.
No, I'm saying thank you. There's nothing wrong with
Mike,
that.
Mike Katziff and I often sit around talking about how much we love Porsches.
Yes, exactly. How much
I'm
we...
So, I'm personally a fan of cashmere.
Oh, no, just stop right now. Fortunately for everyone, that brings us to the end of another Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon. That's W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. That is Trey with an E and Graham like the cracker. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are chair dancing to as we speak. And thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for being here. And I will see you after I get back from London next week.
Actually, could you do a take of that, Linda, where you say, Chim Chim Cheree?
No, I can't.